This episode of the Fleabag Situation is brought to you by Discount Silk-like pajamas with flamingos on them.
You just saw Phoebe Waller-Bridge wearing amazing tiger print silk pajamas, and now you want them too. But whoa, look at that price tag. You now realize you don't have a multi-million dollar deal with Amazon. So it's time to turn to Discount Silk-like pajamas with flamingos on them.
You may not be Phoebe Waller-Bridge, but now you can be Phoebe Waller-Bridge-like with Discount Silk-like pajamas with flamingos on them.
Father, we have a cupcake situation over here.
Okay, Pam, I will be there to cupcake.
Good morning, Allie.
Good morning, Chrissy.
It's Saturday morning. Well, barely. It's 11:47. And here's something I find funny. Archie just asked me, why do you and Allie record so early? And I was like, well, actually for us, 11, we always shoot for 11. And
then texting
starts.
Do you mean by late? Do you mean we always record late?
We always record later than we plan to.
I was thinking of that this morning because I was like, we are such a good team because both of us need like 15 minutes.
We get it. And we are Chrissy Moore.
I'm Allie Lemko-Torin, but we are collectively Chrissy Moore.
Collectively, we are Chrissy Moore and Allie Lemko-Torin because we're the same person. And this is the Fleabag Situation. Good morning. We are still kind of recovering, frankly, because last night, we're recording this on Saturday, the 13th of February. And we got a little news drop on a Friday night that Phoebe and Donald Glover are creating and starring in a new show together, which we'll get to. But wow.
I'm flipping my shit. Those are my two favorite people.
I know.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to talk about it.
Yeah, we'll get to it. But first, we want to tout this is also a very special episode because we got to talk to Dan Gage, who was the assistant editor on season 2 of Fleabag, and is also the editor of Staged, which has become a lockdown favorite for a lot of people, which was had Michael Sheen and David Tennant as playing versions of themselves who were supposed to do a play, and then the director suggests they rehearse over Zoom, and it kind of just devolves from there. And it also in season 2 has a cameo from a certain writer, actor, Harry Styles dance partner, who we all know and love. So that was such a fun conversation. God, that was a highlight of yesterday.
It was, you guys, we had so much fun. I think you're going to enjoy listening because we had a ball.
He was so, I mean, first of all, generous with his time, which all of these people are who talk to us. And because we had talked and we're like, yeah, we usually take about an hour, which I was like, Chrissy, that's a lie. That's just a flat out lie that you take an hour for anything regarding this podcast. You lied to a very nice man. Fortunately, he is so nice that he was like, and we sent him our questions and he was like, I think this is gonna take more than an hour. I'm gonna stock up on green beans, which was a great little inside joke about for the podcast peeps about the fact that everybody in a dinner scene on Fleabag eats green beans, except Martin, who has trouble eating green beans.
Yeah, he misses his mouth.
But yeah, we ended up talking for like 2.5 hours with him.
Well, and we kind of tried to sign off. Like we wanted to be like respectful of the time. And then he was like, oh wait, I thought of this other thing. We were like, great, please continue.
That's my favorite line to hear when I'm sure for any reporter, hardcore journalist like we are. But when someone will go, this is actually a funny story. And I'm like, oh, here we go.
Like ding, ding, ding.
It's great.
Send the endorphins right out to
my brain. Oh my God. And also to the question that had come up from a lot of people when we talk about Dan Gage is the alleged blooper reel that Gary Dolner kind of passed the buck over to Dan Gage and was like, oh, I don't know about it. If anybody knew, it'd be Dan. Well, Gary didn't know. We were just going to call up Dan and ask him directly.
Gotcha, Gary.
So you'll have to listen for his answer to that. But it's a big day. Happy Chinese New Year from yesterday or for Thursday. Happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you. Happy Valentine's Day.
It's actually tomorrow's Valentine's Day. And then the biggest day is Happy Hugh Dennis's birthday.
Big day. I celebrate every year. I don't know about you.
So let's see. How old do you think Hugh Dennis is?
Oh my God. Maybe like 48.
Oh.
Am I young? Is that?
He's 58. But here's the thing. No, that's good. What am I saying? Oh, he's 58. Well, you know, he does look 48.
Well, also,
so he looks younger than he is.
I am notoriously terrible at telling how old people are.
Well, but that was good because he does look younger.
Yeah, he does.
He is. So the moral of this story is we will never have Hugh Dennis appear on this podcast because I know he's listening.
No, he just said he was young. I just said he looked younger than he is.
Which exactly is a major compliment because he does look awesome. I also have started to question when people are like, you look great for that age, because you start to be like, well, I'm 44. I'm not like on the verge of death. Like for someone to go, oh, you like, like, well, how old do you think a 44-year-old is supposed to look? This is on Wikipedia. Peter Hugh Dennis, Hugh's his middle name, is an English comedian, presenter, actor, writer, impressionist. What? I want to hear some Hugh Dennis impressions.
Yes, please.
Anyway.
I have not been using my headphones.
Oh, here we go.
I think it'll
everybody's be. Everybody's like, wow, the quality's about to rocket.
I know. Just get ready, you guys.
Adjust your subwoofers.
Impressive quality of the free Apple headphones coming your way.
Whoever wrote us that review saying, please don't ever improve the quality of your audio, you're in luck. Because we haven't. How's that?
Well, actually, didn't we discuss like getting the mics?
We did, and then that kind of went away real quick.
Didn't do it.
Well, you know why? Because I actually put them away, and I'm too lazy to pull them out.
You know what? I think it's fine.
It's all good.
It's a pandemic, people.
Tomorrow is Valentine's Day. Do you do anything for Valentine's Day?
No.
Yeah, Allie was shaking her head and then realized she's on the radio.
Yeah, I'm on the radio. No, we don't. We just like, I'm a big birthday person and my birthday is in March. So I feel like yeah. I'm just like very focused on, are you writing down my?
I am writing down Allie's birthday. What's that date again?
That's so thoughtful. My birthday is, well, I'll tell you later because I just read that you're not supposed to post your vaccine card because if people have your name and your birthday, they can figure out your social security.
Okay. Even though I think we have posted it on the Facebook.
I think we have too, but it's fine. I won't tell the masses, but
I have a lot of March birthdays and they all kind of.
I also have a lot of March birthdays. Yeah. March was, people were.
What was going on? I guess June, school's out, everybody.
I guess. I was born 2 months early, so I was more like September, I think.
Back to school, feeling good. Yeah. I don't know.
August. Anyway, math is hard. No, we just hang out. I did use it as excuse to buy the new gluten-free Oreos.
Oh.
I was literally just like, I keep getting ads for chocolate and stuff. I'm going to do this. Happy Valentine's Day to me. I haven't had an Oreo since 2012. And I fucking love Oreos. Who doesn't love Oreos?
The best.
So I ate a lot of Oreos last night and it was like, just, it was really great.
Did they taste good? I mean,
they taste the exact same. They're okay. Phenomenal. I'm going to make dirt pie. Do you know dirt pie? Like Oreo dirt?
I know where you're making like an Oreo crust, but I've never heard of dirt pie.
Oh, so my favorite childhood recipe or dessert was you just crush up a bunch of Oreos and then you make chocolate pudding and you basically put the crushed Oreos on top of the chocolate pudding. And then on Halloween, when we would get booed, like our neighbors would like boo us, which is like when you surprise someone with like Halloween candy and stuff, and then you have to do it to somebody else.
Okay.
And so we would get booed and then our boo gift to our neighbors would be making an Oreo dirt cemetery and we would get Milanos and like write RIP on them. And we'd get the peeps that look like ghosts and like put them in little gummy worms. It's a cherished childhood memory. Honestly, also my mother was big on the crafts. So
I was about to say, this is all, she was like, all you do, here's all you do. You just here's 20 steps.
It's actually so easy.
You pudding, you crumble some stuff, you buy some this, you do that, put it on this, decorate it with whatever, then you're done.
But also it kept the kids busy for an hour. So.
Okay, there's so much here. Getting booed is a thing that we never had. Is that a Northeast thing?
I don't know. I think that the Children's Hospital of Atlanta does it here. It's like a fundraiser.
Right in your yard or something.
Yeah, but I always assumed, based on my experiences, that they did bring, that you'd like...
They bring you something?
Boo you. Yeah, I don't know. Basically, for us, I don't know, in Connecticut, they would just, I don't know why, you'd write like boo on a big piece of paper, and then you'd like put it on the front porch, and then with like a bunch of candy or a basket of some treats or something. And so our thing was this Oreo thing.
Because I know the Children's Hospital, I have seen, like, I think you make a donation and you get a sign.
Oh.
That says boo, and you put it in your yard. And then I didn't realize that I just thought it was a way to tell people I've donated to the Children's Hospital. I didn't know that maybe they do bring you something.
I don't know either.
I just think it's funny that, like, as if we don't get enough candy in Halloween, it's like, let's come up with a new way to get candy.
I mean, I can imagine parents are like, are you serious? I just handmade a costume. You want me to make a fucking pie now too?
Well, and then is in the Northeast, don't they also have something called Mischief Night?
Yeah, do you not have that here?
We never had Mischief Night growing up.
Oh, I thought that was just...
We have it here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not great. It's like when teenagers go around and hit mailboxes with baseball bats and toilet paper people's houses.
So basically vandalism night.
It's literally vandalism. You didn't
have the purge. It's the kids' version of the purge. You get to go out and just, you know, bash every mailbox and egg every house you've ever wanted to.
I thought that was like American. I didn't know that was
I think Northeast. That is regional to the Northeast.
Wow, we're they suck up there.
okay, dirt pie, because we have friends who have a Halloween party every year, or used to in the before times, and they make something called Ghosts in the Graveyard. That's basically a cup of chocolate pudding and crumbled Oreos on top, and then a little dollop of Cool Whip.
Oh.
It specifically has to be Cool Whip, not just whipped cream. Cool Whip is the deal.
Well, ghosts are made of Cool Whip. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows that. That's science. And we go nuts. Like, he literally will be like, Ghosts in the Graveyard already. And we're all just like, blah! And then he's like, y'all realize you could make these literally every day. Like, they're the easiest thing, but they have to be special as part of Halloween. We've spent a lot of time talking about Halloween, considering we started talking about Valentine's Day.
I was just going to say that, but Oreo, you know what? The magic of Oreos. This episode brought to you by gluten-free Oreos. They're in stores now, people. And they're vegan. It's just everything is good. Nothing I'm allergic to.
I have discovered Tim Tams.
Oh.
I don't know if they're also in England or if it's just or around the world, but they're definitely Australian because there was a clip. So Selena Gomez has a show on HBO Max.
Of course.
It's going somewhere. She has a show on HBO Max where she cooks with celebrity. Like, she has celebrity chefs on Zoom, and then she's cooking in her like massive kitchen because she's done very well.
Good.
And but then they had like a little special video of Curtis Stone, who's an Australian chef, sent her a box of Australian treats, and so she was taste testing them. The Vegemite. This was the best part. She literally just dipped a spoon into the Vegemite and just started, and then almost like threw up.
Did no one tell her?
Well, everybody was like, that's not how you do Vegemite. It's, I mean,
even I know
it was bad. But they had Tim Tams, which are these little chocolate cookies, and Alan had them. He turns and he goes, oh, Tim Tams are the deal. And so Amazon has them. So I ordered Anzac biscuits, which are also an Australian little
look at cookie. You
And then these Tim Tams, which, oh boy. Because they basically, the reason I'm thinking about them is because they taste a little bit like a chocolate covered Oreo. Like, the cookie that's in the middle is a cream and then two layers of cookie. But it's like a thin layer of chocolate. And man, I am team Tim Tam.
This is good to know.
It's funny with Valentine's Day because I think, especially the longer you've been married, like, we have this really special tradition where, like, around February 10th, we just like gaze into each other's eyes and we say, we're not doing anything, right? We're not buying each other anything, right? It's like, no. Because every day is Valentine's Day. When you're in love. No. Usually we used to, like, we would go to dinner and we would always go on like the 13th or the 15th because all the restaurants on the 14th make everything really expensive and it's crowded. And then you're like, this is like, time is arbitrary. Like, why is this day? Why are we spending twice as much?
Right.
But actually that's all in the past now. So
I know.
I can't, the thought of going out to a crowded restaurant for dinner still, it feels very far away.
And that's okay. I want it, but it's crazy. Valentine's Day used to be my favorite because, again, I had a crafty mother and I'm a crafty, I used to be a crafty person. It's been a while.
Did she make heart pie or something?
No, not, that was like really one of her only like baked items. Okay. The boo pie, whatever. No, but she would, every year I would make a little Valentine's Day like box for my cart for the Valentine's cards. And that was like, I remember getting, I would get the February issue of Family Fun magazine. And like, I would like eagerly anticipate its arrival. And then I would like flip and see what they were making for Valentine's boxes.
Okay, Allie, here's the thing. I've never heard of Family Fun magazine. So I think your mom published a magazine called Family Fun and then she would put it in your mailbox. And I think you had a subscription to Family Fun magazine.
No. That would be very impressive. That's all I'll say about that. That would be
okay. All we would do was take, I like that you were like, I'm looking for a trends piece about Valentine's boxes.
I'm sorry, there was no internet.
And meanwhile, I was taking an old Kleenex box and wrapping it in red construction paper and writing in marker like Happy Valentine's
Day. Oh my God. My favorite one, I made a giraffe once and and you used a paper towel roll as the neck. And oh my God, I had a ball. I loved that shit. I loved that shit. But then also, since my mom was a dental hygienist, we didn't give away candy.
We didn't give away candy, just giant pies of chocolate.
Well, that's why that was like such a crazy thing, because I am a child that never got dessert. Like, I ate kashi, you know? It's like this disgusting oat cereal. That's that was my. So that's why that was such a big deal for me. I think my mom was just like, you're eating a bunch of candy at Halloween anyway. Like, fuck it. Like, let's just like, fuck it. But everything else was not food based with her. But no, we would get heart shaped balloons. And then poke a hole in the Valentine's cards and then thread like the little balloon, like the unblown up balloon through it.
Oh, okay.
And it was such a hit. So it's like, yes, I didn't give you candy, but everybody else gave you candy. And now you have a balloon in your second grade classroom, which the teachers were not thrilled about. But also most second graders can't blow up a balloon. So it probably, I don't know.
Wow. That was a journey. we're ordering pancakes for dinner tonight, so I'm pretty happy.
That sounds wonderful.
I'm not even making, we're getting them from Flying Biscuit. So then we'll also have biscuits in the morning. Speaking of love,
we've already talked so long. I won't go on, but I am very excited because I feel like this is melodramatic, but like, I don't know. We're in a pandemic. Everything is hard. And so like pure joy, I'm really trying to like grasp and just like feel as much as possible. And I felt it yesterday because two of my very close friends asked me to officiate their wedding.
God.
And I'm the priest. I know. And I literally, one of my first responses was like, so what I'm hearing is you want me to give the Fleabag homily at your wedding.
Because I will.
Because, like, you know. And they also love Fleabag. They came over and they made me a little Lego wedding ceremony, like, kit thing. And the best part is they also ordered, like, an officiant person. Because it was, like, a bride and a groom and, like, a little chapel-y thing. And they ordered, like, a little character to be me as the officiant. But it didn't come in time. So my friend just was like, the officiant didn't come in time, but I did get a little blonde hair, a little Lego blonde hair thing for it. So here I have the hair. God. I was like, I felt like I got proposed to. I mean, I did. I kind of did.
Ellie's like, yes, I will enter a polyamorous marriage with
you. I'm marrying them. I'm literally marrying them.
Right. So when is the wedding? Are they
my God.
Everything's over or what?
I have to wait like, I have to wait like 2 years.
Oh man.
I know.
Wanted to lock you in. They knew you were in high demand.
I know. Well, I think they're just so excited and they booked the venue because it's like, that's how you get it 2 years from now. It's like, you have to do it now. Sucks. So they're just like moving forward as if it's sooner.
Yeah.
Just because they're excited and they want to do it. And then they'll just be ready for a year basically.
Wow.
But yeah, that was like,
that's amazing.
Next November 2022 is the earliest they could get where they wanted it. So,
but that, you know what? That'll be good though, because hopefully things will have passed and
yeah,
you know, yeah.
It's crazy to think about where we're going to be in two, like, isn't that wild?
It's hard to, I saw there's that meme where it's like someone, well, there's a few versions of it, but there's the one, it's like a drawing of someone being attacked by a guy with like a guy is being attacked with a knife. So there's the guy with the knife and then the guy's got his hands up and the one is like, you know, me still trying to process last March. And then it's like the guy with the knife is like March coming up in like 2 weeks or something. Like,
I know.
It's
going to be weird. Yeah, it's going to get weird.
Well, congratulations. I'm very excited for you.
On your impending.
On your 2 years from now role in somebody else's love. I love it.
I'm excited.
This is just a totally random story. I went out yesterday. I went through, I was wearing my, I looked like a pencil shirt yesterday. And so I went through Starbucks with Archie in the back. And so I'd done a mobile order and we got there like fast. And so the girl was like waiting for it to get made. And then she looks and she goes, oh, I like your shirt. What does that say? And I was like, I look like a pencil. And I said, it's from Fleabag. And she's like, oh, what is that? And I was like, oh, it's a show. And she goes, what's it about? Here's a fun fact. I have no idea how to explain what Fleabag is about. Because what I said was, oh, it's about this like single woman in London and she's like kind of processing the loss of her best friend and her mom and she's kind of going through a lot of grief, but it's really funny. But I was like, stop talking. Like you're making it sound terrible. And I was like, and then season two is just really funny. It's just like a love story. And like, she falls in love with a priest. And so I think in the future, I'm just going to say it's about a woman who falls in love with a priest. That's going to be my hook.
That works.
Because how would you describe it? There's no simple hook.
I used to, when people would ask when the podcast was new, I used to be like, it's about a woman. Yeah. Single woman in London in her like 30s. Who deals with grief through like sex and humor.
That's, yeah.
That was kind of my thing. But yeah. It's hard. It's
even that doesn't capture it.
I know. I agree.
Just, I should just be like, just watch it. Yeah. So I was like, it's great, vroom. Like, I'm sure she's like, what the hell was that?
That's what happens when you ask questions.
Yeah, exactly. Why don't you just bring me my coffee and shut it?
Oh my God.
I'm kidding. That's
I know.
No. That's my attitude. No, I should have stickers ready to hand out all the time and just be like,
oh my God,
the podcast.
Yeah, just leave them in your glove compartment next to your
totally.
Like registration.
You should just have a dispenser installed like on the ceiling of the car. Like, you know, like one of those little post-it dispensers. Yes.
Here's my credit card and a sticker.
I would like to clarify that is not my attitude toward baristas, and I really value all service workers, and especially now.
Yes, we know.
You're like, yeah, Kristen, we know. You're we know. Most of the time. Let's jump to, well, initially what we thought was the sole Fleabag related news.
Yes.
Last night, Allie and I literally were like, wow, there's really not a lot going on, is there? What are we going to talk about?
And the Fleabag gods heard us.
So the one thing you had initially written.
Yeah. Was... So there's a comedy show in the UK called Inside Number 9, which side note looks amazing. And I'm kind of surprised I've never heard about it. So the sixth series is coming out soon, or it ended filming recently. And so they released the news that Sean Clifford is going to be in it as well as Nick Mohammed from Ted Lasso.
Yeah.
And that's what we thought was the only.
We literally, new. Yeah, we literally were like, and that's it. And then it was at like dinner time, right?
Yeah.
And I went on Twitter and I'm trying to think how I first heard about it. I think I saw Phoebe Waller-Bridge source on Twitter retweet it. And it was one of those things where you're like, your body starts telling you, like you start feeling the feelings before you've actually processed what's actually happening. And like when you're falling, you know, when you like trip and fall in the street and you're like, something's changing. And that's how I thought. I was like, wait a minute. I know him. I know her. Wait, what? Huh? And then I was like, wait, this is just like, they're producing something or like whatever. And yeah. I was like, wait, they're starring. It's that. And like, I just started freaking out. And then I sent it to you.
But would you like to share what is actually happening?
Let's talk about what it is. So Donald Glover on Instagram released this little teaser video, basically announcing the news that he and Phoebe Waller-Bridge are co-creating and starring in a reboot of Mr. and Mrs. Smith based on the 2005 movie.
Brangelina.
And Brad Pitt, which by the way, ended up with them falling in love. So somebody on Instagram, I mean, on our Facebook group, Autumn was actually like, she goes, they're in love. And I'm like, what if they are? What if they became a couple? Oh my God. Like, I don't know what her status is with Martin McDonagh right now.
I don't. He has a partner and a baby.
Oh, he does?
Yes.
Oh.
But well, you know so what? Did.
They were all partnered up back in 2005.
That's true. Jennifer Aniston would beg to differ.
Exactly. Now, we don't want to ruin any families. We just love these two together. And so, and he announced that it's going to be on Amazon and it's 2022. It's coming out. So your friend's getting married and Donald and Phoebe are about to fall in love. So
I literally got
2022 is our year.
It really is. I like how we're saying this in February of the year before, but, but absolutely no. When you sent me that news, it was like 20 minutes after my friends had come over to ask me to officiate. And I was like, what am I more excited about? Which is better? I mean, I think the officiate thing is better, but also this is the best possible situation. Donald Glover and Phoebe are my two favorite people, period. Like in like the film and television universe. And I'm like, you know, it just feels great. Side note, I looked up her silk pajamas from that video immediately.
Yes.
They are $150. So I didn't buy them, but I did buy silk pajamas. I was influenced.
Yeah.
But I also, and I got them on Poshmark. So they have been.
Okay.
There, because I'm trying to be better ethical clothing sourcing. Sure. And stuff. But anyway, I will have silk pajamas with flamingos coming to me shortly. In honor, I don't know.
Well, yeah. So the video was basically like Donald Glover like setting up a selfie camera and then starting to do like the floss dance,
like a TikTok thing. Yeah,
like a quick. But and then it cuts off to Phoebe wearing glasses, looking at the screen. And then like getting up and revealing these like amazing silk pajamas with like snakes on them. What were they?
I think they're tigers.
Tigers. They were tigers. And then like doing this kind of like flirty pose in the doorway. And then it cuts to just black and white text, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So, I guess it's part, like we were reading the Hollywood Reporter article about it. I guess they didn't break the news. Donald Glover broke the news. Yeah. And I guess this is this is part of her Amazon deal.
That makes sense.
And so they said it'll be like her official follow-up to Fleabag. And that he also, I guess, has renewed his deal at FX. So he's still doing Atlanta while he's also doing this.
Gotcha.
So huge. Well, and then a really cool little connection, because Jonathan Paul Green has posted on his Instagram that he's working on the new season of Atlanta.
Yeah, and he's the production designer of Fleabag, who we've talked to a bunch.
Exactly.
So how fun is that?
Yeah, it's just like worlds collide.
I love it.
Love it. So that was, I've watched that video like 20 times. I kind of don't get it. Like,
I know.
I was like, I understand the announcement and that's huge. I kind of don't get, like, is it supposed to be that she's reacting to what he's doing? And so
Yeah, or it's like they're different styles, but then like, why is his part only like actually 2 seconds and her part is like 10 seconds? Like,
right, right.
But I guess all will be revealed in a year.
Yeah. I was like, is he trying to impress her with his dance, like his like floss dance? And then she's like, I'm impressed, so I'm going to go stand sexy in this doorway.
Slink up to the doorframe. In my silk tiger pajamas.
And what was the song he was doing it to at the beginning?
Oh, I don't even know.
Wait, hang on.
Oh no, I have to watch it again.
Well, because now I'm just curious. Because it changes. It like starts with... That's right. And then it changes to her like... Okay, well, we'll just watch that 20 more times later. Yeah, it's just so funny that we literally had written, unfortunately, there has not been a lot of Fleabag news lately.
Psych.
Oops. But now I think we've chatted enough because we are excited to get to our conversation with Dan Gage.
Yes.
Like I said, we talked to him yesterday. And so if you are, I mean, you're obviously a Fleabag fan if you're listening to this, but if you are also a fan of Staged, which we had posted in our Facebook group that we were talking to him, like all these Staged fans started coming out of the woodwork. We got to talk to him about that too. And we love talking to him. We hope you all enjoy listening to it.
I know. And if you want to watch Staged before you hear us talk about it, because there are spoilers.
Good call.
Then it's on in the US, it's on Hulu, the first season. The second season is not. It will, I'm sure it'll come soon.
A lot of people have, a lot of people have a VPN. You can go, it's on the iPlayer. So if you're in, if you have access to the BBC iPlayer from where you are, season two is there, or if you're outside, you might be able to VPN into it.
Yes. And then you can watch it again and give them your money once it is available.
Correct. And I'm sure season two will come to Hulu very soon.
Yeah, totally. And it's just a delight. Like we both like were texting each other like, oh, this is excellent. We are kind of obsessed.
Really geeking out about this.
Yeah, like now there's a bit of a stage situation. So anyway, without further ado, here's our conversation with Dan Gage.
Dan Gage, thank you so much for joining us. We're so excited to have you on the podcast finally.
Yes, pleasure. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
How has your lockdown been aside from stage, which we'll get to in a little bit? We have a lot of questions about stage, but just personally, how are you guys doing over there?
Good. So I mean, I'm locked in with my wife, Charlotte, who is an assistant editor, and we got a dog just while I was cutting stage to the first series. So yeah, that's been fun. We've sort of had three lockdowns here in the UK. So the first two, I was working. And so this is the first time really I haven't been sort of working all day. So I'm sort of getting used to the long days and finding things to do. So this came at a good time for me.
Good.
You're experiencing what we've been through for, like, well, this is what we've been talking about for a year.
Yeah.
What state are you guys in now in terms of lockdown?
I sort of let it carry on in the background. At first, when last sort of March, April, I was a bit of a COVID expert and knew all the ramifications of all the rules. But yeah, I think there's going to be some announcement within the next week or so that might indicate when the lockdown is going to be relaxed a little bit. But at the minute, you're not really supposed to leave your area or see anyone outside of your household. So yeah, it's pretty hardcore lockdown. How about for you?
It's so funny. We feel like the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yeah. We live in Georgia. So we had like a 2-week suggested lockdown a year ago. And since then, people don't really.
Oh, wow. So since then, nothing.
I mean, there's masks and we're in the Atlanta metro area. So we're in a city. People are better about it. But in general, you know.
Yeah, you got to some areas outside of the city and it's like nothing's wrong almost. Like schools are open and, you know, we have a 6-year-old and so we've been back and forth about if the school's going to open, if it's not, and so far it's been closed, which we're thankful for. But it is funny because the rates here are still really high. And, you know, we've got like thousands of cases a week. And then I have a friend I met through Fleabag, actually, who lives in Melbourne, Australia. And she was like, we're going back into lockdown because we have 13 cases. It's like, no, I saw that we have too. Like 1,300 and we're like out and about. So we, Allie and I, are staying home. We've been basically...
We're in our own lockdown.
Yeah.
Yeah. So self-inflicted. Yeah, there was a period last year, sort of summertime, where there was a bit of a release over here. But yeah, we didn't really go anywhere either. So yeah, I think that's the best way to be until it's a bit safer.
Well, hopefully the vaccine, Dr. Fauci is saying like by April, it'll be open season to get the vaccine. So we're hoping.
Yeah, in the US. So I know it's different everywhere, but just got to keep our heads down and keep watching Fleabag.
Try and get through it,
yes. having fun with the podcast and everything.
Yeah, great way to spend your time. I actually hurtled through series two of Fleabag again this morning. So that was lots of fun. Yeah. So it's fresh in my mind.
Excellent.
Isn't that the magic of it, is that you can just watch it in a few hours?
Yeah, so brilliant. And also, you don't want to stop once you get going on it as well, because it's so gripping.
Yeah.
It's the first time I've watched it for probably since I watched it go out. So it was really cool. And it's great to have distance when you work on something and come back to it. And there were moments in there that I'd totally forgotten about. So, which I loved.
How is it for you to watch it, having known it so intimately, getting it made?
To come back to it or
yeah,
to watch
can you
it?
Watch it objectively? Or are you watching and going, I remember that, I remember that?
Yeah, a bit of both. Actually, sometimes I have, I can easily sort of sit into something and just let it wash over me in the same way that you would. But yeah, then you remember fun moments and things that were sort of happening behind the scenes in the cutting room or around certain things. Sometimes I have to really force myself to think about it analytically or critically, which I think is a really good gift for somebody who works in the industry, because you're not hampering your enjoyment of the thing, of the show then. So I do that from time to time with shows that I've worked on that I've enjoyed working on. I'll try and watch them a couple of years later. It was a really good experience.
Was there anything that came back to you this morning as you were watching it? Like
so many things. I just had a flashback actually too. There was one episode where there hadn't been as much work on it during the assembly. And I just had a flashback to Gary walking down the corridor and just calming everyone down and everyone just following him into the edit room. So that was really funny. That was a really cool moment just to experience how calm he was at sort of dealing with those potential issues. And of course there was no problem with it at all. Just things like that, little flashbacks to situations.
He seems like a very chill dude. When we interviewed him and he was like chilling out on his couch with his dog, we were just chatting away, you know. I bet it's nice in a really high, like intense environment like that, where you got to get a lot done fast, to have sort of a calming presence like that.
Yeah, it's really key, I think. I mean, different people handle it in different ways and it's what works for you. But as an assistant, it's great to have a really, really calm editor. I imagine it's great for a director and a producer, a writer as well, to sort of not get a sense of panic from them. But I think it helps that he's just totally focused on the story and how to get the best out of it. So it's great. But also having a higher level of energy and reaction to it is can also work. And I've worked with editors who react like that too. It's just about how to get it over the line.
Yeah, I mean, it sounded like, especially talking to Jonathan, that the production was actually a little run and gun. Like it felt very frantic. So how did that translate for you guys as you're receiving dailies and starting to put assemblies together?
That never really translates. I mean, we sort of got a sense that they were shooting a hell of a lot of footage, like so much for a six-part, 30-minute comedy. There was so much coming in. But we never got a sense from watching anything, nothing sort of pre-roll, nothing during the takes, that there was any panic or anything that was sort of last minute or, you know. I mean, the rushes were great. As an assistant, you're the first person to see them, so that's a real privilege. It was just calmness and confidence. So yeah, that didn't come across at all.
So how did you end up on Fleabag? You didn't work on season one, right? You were just on season two?
Yeah, so it's normally the editor that takes you onto the job as an assistant, or sometimes on the bigger productions, a post-production supervisor. So on The Crown, for example, I went on as a second, but the team was assembled by the post-production supervisor there, on series one anyway. I ended up on Fleabag through Gary, who I worked with on a show called Wanderlust for Drama Republic, which is, I think Wanderlust is on Netflix at the minute, if you haven't seen it. So I went on to that show with a different editor called Johnny Rayner, who I'd built up a relationship with from a couple of years earlier. We were up in Manchester assembling, and then Gary came on board for the second block. So often on dramas, it gets split up into blocks where one director and editor takes the first block and another director and editor takes the second block. So Gary came on board for block two. And often on these things, as an assistant, you join the show with one editor and then they leave and go off and do something else. So then you're left to either build a relationship with the editor that remains or you go in a totally separate direction. But me and Gary clicked and became friends, and I was able to help him out. I think he had he had to have a week off at some point. So I helped him out assembling some of the rushes on Wanderlust. And yeah, quite early on, actually, I was trying to niggle him to see what he was doing next. And eventually he was like, well, I might be doing Fleabag. But I think there was a question mark on dates. So, I hadn't actually seen Fleabag at the time. So I went back and watched it all in a night that did the same thing. And I made it known to him that I wanted to go with him. And it just sort of went from there. And between that, we went on to another show called Turn Up Charlie, actually. So I bounced from job to job with him. And then I left Turn Up Charlie to go with him for Fleabag. So yeah, that's how it works. You get taken along with the editor. So it's good to have sort of two or three that you have good relationships with as an assistant. And Gary, I often find as an assistant as well, and this also happens as an editor, you sort of navigate or gravitate to people that have similar tastes to you, similar tastes in music, similar interests, similar hobbies. And I guess people are just looking, as well as your talent as an assistant, people are looking for sort of a common interest so they can spend 3 to 6 months with you as well in a cutting room.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Gary had mentioned that was part of like the kismet of the team on Fleabag. As he said, we just liked spending time together. Like, if you're all going to be in a box together, you better enjoy it.
Yeah, and box is the word as well.
So for some of our listeners who don't know, can you explain what the role of an assistant editor is? Like, what was your typical day like on, I guess you weren't on set, but on, you know, when Fleabag was shooting, or were you on set?
I've been on set twice as an assistant, but neither time was actually on set. You're sort of in a room in a studio somewhere. So you're never really in amongst it. Yeah, Fleabag was sort of on location, shooting around London, and we were in Soho in a cutting room there. So yeah, an assistant editor's job is basically to support the editor as much as you can. So you're having conversations with the DIT, occasionally the producer, and you're sort of all the time you're weighing up how much to bring your editor into those conversations, what they need to know, whilst also taking the dailies in, or we call them rushes in the UK, taking the rushes from set every day, processing those, organizing them in the most efficient way, depending on what your editor wants and how quickly it takes to do the work. Then you are sort of uploading them for the director, producers, writer, whoever has permissions to see them. And often the edit breaks down into the shoot and the fine cut. So on the shoot, you're doing as much as you can to support your editor, to give them the time that they need to watch the rushes and communicate with whoever they need to do. And you can be the conduit for that. Once you've processed the rushes for the day, it's things like finding sound effects, bringing music in, doing little VFX comps on screens, for example, for Fleabag. There wasn't a great deal of VFX for Fleabag.
So is that stuff like when she's looking at her computer?
Yeah. And there are different versions of that. So, and actually that continues throughout the edit, but you're doing as much as you can to help the editor put a first cut together, like a first assembly. At the end of the week, the editor can then send off his or her week's work in the most polished way, or as much as they would like it polished. Some editors don't like their assemblies to have a lot of sound effects or music on. Yeah, and then liaising with, often you do tests early on with the final post teams. So you're liaising with them, you're talking to the post-production supervisor. We had a really great one on Fleabag too called Sarah Irvin, who I became good friends with. Basically, doing as much work as you can to make people feel calm about the production if they ever check in with you. So if you need to know where everything is, have links ready, just be prepared for any questions that come your way. Mm. And also, yeah, so they're your two things, supporting the editor and being ready to field questions from outside the cutting room.
The more I learn about editing, like the more I'm love it. Like it's such a critical role in shaping what the show becomes. It feels like it's such a combination of like organization, which Allie and I both love, and creativity. Like it's like both parts of your brain.
Yeah, and also I was never aware of this before I went into it, but a certain level of technical knowledge helps as well. But yeah, organization is key. As an assistant, actually, this is one thing that I thought that I sort of learned as I went along. You basically expand to fill the gaps that your editor doesn't want to deal with. So some editors aren't very organized, so you have to fill that gap, otherwise the project gets messy. Some editors like to do VFX work, but if they don't, you have to fill that gap, otherwise the VFX work doesn't get done. So often you have to be flexible and be able to turn in different directions to sort of, there are certain things that need to be hit for the edit to get done. And every editor is different and likes to do different things and likes to work in with different ways and prioritize different things. So one of your jobs is to sort of be able to expand your expertise or bring them back if an editor wants to take control of something. So yeah, it's about being flexible and doing the best you can to support the edit, yeah.
We found we've been just reading all about you all week, just, you know, don't be alarmed.
It shouldn't have taken you long.
But we found an article from your like alumni magazine, your school alumni website, saying that you originally were a writer and director before you made your way to editing, and that kind of helps inform how you edit. What drew you over to editing from writing and directing?
Maybe that's a little bit misleading. So I was interested in all three things, writing, directing, and editing. When you first start, or when I first started, you did everything. I did everything. So I was making shorts, really bad shorts, with like my sister and my friends and my grandparents helping me out and all of that sort of stuff. But you write it because in the town that I was from, there weren't many people interested in filmmaking. There were some people who were actors and had ambitions to go down that path. But yeah, outside of my course that I was on. So you're just sort of doing everything. And I was really interested in the three things that I considered to be, this isn't strictly true, but the three main storytelling roles. Every role is a storytelling role, but as a teenager, they were the three that I was really interested in. I always knew, particularly when I went to university, people at university would edit in groups. So we would make group projects where we'd all do different roles. And when I was in the cutting room, I was always the person that would be there the longest, working through the night. People would come back and comment on the meticulousness of the cuts or be excited by something that I'd done. So it was always clear quite early on that editing was the thing that was perhaps going to land first. But I was always trying to chase all three. And actually, as a kid, I was mostly interested in writing. And my family always used to say that I would be a writer. So that's something that I loved, and I liked the idea of directing, but I'm really glad that I tried it out. And yes, as that article says, it has been really useful. But editing was the thing that I always knew was going to land first, and subsequently it has. And I think it's the thing that I'm better at. I'd still try and write sometimes. Yeah, I'm much better at sort of embellishing someone else's idea, which is great for an editor.
Yeah.
But to answer your question directly, yeah. So that's how I got into it. And yeah, it's I've made probably between 10 and 15 shorts, all of varying qualities. Eventually, some of them got quite good, relatively. And but it's a really great experience to go through those, to have that pressure on you to perform those roles. And I'm always drawing on those experiences as an assistant to try and think about what might have been going on that set that day, if you can't understand what's going on with the rushes, or as an editor to try and put yourself in the mindset of what the director was attempting to achieve. They're really great experiences to draw on as a resource.
We spoke with Gary a few months ago, and we talked with him about how he, you know, I think somebody in the cast had credited him as a writer, you know, in theory, Phoebe. On the show too. Phoebe, yeah. Because he contributed so much. So I'm sure, and I'm interested, once we get to our staged portion, I'm interested to hear how that experience was for you. But back to Fleabag for the meantime, this is kind of a silly question, but I'm curious, what's your favorite episode? Was there one where you got the rushes on the day and you were like, oh my God, I've watched this scene like 15 times and I still love it?
There are no scenes that I ever got bored of or felt that, you know, got sick of or anything like that. You sort of see something new in it every time. Even this morning when I was watching it, you see something new in it. And also when you're working on it, the edits are coming in and they're different. And you're looking at how Gary, Phoebe and Harry have taken something that was much longer and have really cleverly condensed it, brought it down. So yeah, there's always something to take from it. In terms of my favorite episode, obviously series 2, episode 1 is astonishing, but there are moments that I just love in all of the episodes. Like the episode 6 is great. The episode 4, Fleabag in the confessional booth. In fact, the moments that I most love are actually the more, not dramatic, but I guess they are the more dramatic moments. In a comedy, they often are the moments that I find myself ruminating on afterwards, and they're the moments that I really love. There are obviously so many brilliant comedic moments in there as well, but yeah, episode 1 I think is the one.
Well, I think those dramatic moments are what give the show depth beyond just a, you know, joke.
Yeah,
because we've both said that for us, like episode 4 of season 1, when she's talking to the bank manager and he has that kind of dramatic monologue about his wife and you know, wanting to take clean cups out of the dishwasher, like that just immediately, I think that's when I became all this. Dive right into the show. It adds weight to it. So I think I relate to that.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, it's relatable human experiences, I think, because life is sort of, without getting too pretentious too early, life is funny and painful often at the same time. So yeah, and often those dramatic moments are underscored with a comedic beat, and not even underscored, that is, it's inherent underneath it through the scene as well. But yeah, they're the moments that I really love in Fleabag.
Well, I think you just described the appeal of the show, the pain and humor together, because that is the human experience.
Yeah.
Phoebe has I read somewhere, so often I'll do this, if I start working with someone, I'll try and research interviews and things by them. And I found a really great one where Phoebe was talking about Tickle Tickle Slap or Tickle Tickle Punch. Have you read that one?
Yeah.
Such a great approach to take on this sort of show.
Or that she's, you know, laughing, like laughing literally opens up your chest to get punched right in the heart.
Yeah, and Gary often says actually laughing and crying is, he feels is a similar, takes you to a similar place. So it's really playful to be able to take you to one and then sort of segue into another from it.
Right. And by the way, it's never too early to get pretentious on this podcast.
Well, it's only 10:30 over there as well, isn't it?
That's true.
Hey, it's almost 11.
Almost 11. It's okay. Basically lunch. And what I'm saying is time for dinner.
Some other of my favorite moments in series 2 were the flashbacks to Boo that would sort of interspersed mainly in the, was it episode 4 that's the funeral? Yeah, that ends with the kneel. Mm-hmm. There's some of those examples of the story just heading in one direction and then just in a cut, taking you somewhere emotionally totally different and then taking you straight back.
Yeah.
That was some really clever and smart editing, I think, from Gary. And also the way that he dealt with the flashback at the end of series 1 was fantastic, I thought.
Yeah, we talked with him about that. And he said a lot of it wasn't planned ahead of time. It was sort of, you know, he just figured out like, all right, flashback here, let's put one here. And to me, that's incredible to not have it sketched out and just to sort of go with the feel of it. I'm like in awe.
He was speaking a lot about that on series two, actually. I think he had a concern that they were going to have to lock the episodes without knowing how much of each flashback was right to reveal. So he was totally, or they were totally sort of feeling their way through it, but they did a great job.
Yeah.
Yeah, we actually had a question that had come in on the Facebook group from Diane asking, are flashbacks a challenge to edit? Thinking specifically about the funeral, like, was there a lot of footage and how that got pieced together?
That's probably a question for Gary. I don't think they're necessarily more of a challenge to edit. It's about the story, I think, and the footage that you get. I guess the challenge is how to tell a flashback in an interesting way. I think Fleabag used a new approach for flashbacks, sort of quick cuts, mostly silent, that I thought drew the emotion out of it, difficult than anything else. They're just different ways of telling the story that you need to make sure feel like a natural segue.
So what you were talking about, you know, that your role as an assistant, did you have a chance to do a final cut on any of the scenes?
In Fleabag,
yeah.
No, I did assemble. So there were some scenes that were picked up quite late in the edit. So Gary's working away cutting episode one, and there are new rushes that come in. So you want to be able to give your editor a scene to put in if he wants to watch the whole thing through so he can see the shape of it. So Gary then does go back and watch all the rushes himself. But you as an assistant, you want to give the editor the support that you can. So I put those two scenes together. I mean, it was nothing like what ended up in the cut. But actually, do you get the recaps in the US at the start of the shows?
No, the like previously on, basically, we don't. The only way I've seen some of those, you know, you can find sources online that do have them, but we didn't get them on Prime over here.
Okay. So I would never want to encourage you to watch it illegally.
Of course not.
But if you did happen upon them, then you'd see some recaps at the front. So as an assistant editor, that's your chance to shine, really. So yeah, all of those recaps were entirely the assistant. Gary may have tweaked a few, but yeah, they're often that's your route up. You sort of, sometimes the producers get involved in those, so you can build relationships that way. And Phoebe and Gary and Harry as well, actually, would all come and gather in their room sometimes at the end of the day, just spring it on you, be like, show us this recap. So that's a good way to start to build relationships with the people who might eventually employ you as an assistant.
And then you cut the season two trailer also, right?
So yeah, there were a few series two trailers, but I was in the set. So after Fleabag, I was trying to wait for an editing job. And it was the first time I'd had like more than a week off for probably 5 years. So I was trying to go and see films at the cinema. And so every day I was trying to go and see a film. And I was sat in the cinema one day and I had a call from Phoebe. And she wanted me to have a look at a trailer for them. So there were a few trailers eventually, but the one that went out on the BBC, the first one that went out was one that I put together. So that was great. That was a really cool moment for me. So I'd had a few jobs where I'd helped with recaps and that had led to something else. But for Phoebe to come back and ask me to do something more for Fleabag was great. And it's not often that BBC trailers get cut from people outside of their trailer team. So that the fact that it ended up on being broadcast did a lot for my confidence.
I'm always so impressed with the recaps on any show because it means that that person really has to understand every part of the show and like everything that contributes from the last preview or from the previous episodes to the recent one. Like you really got to go get the meat of it. Right. So that you remind people and get those exact quotes. That's just enough. Like I'm just a nerd. I'm a video editor too. And so I'll notice some stuff sometimes like that. And I'm just very impressed.
And to not give away too much. Cause as a viewer, you're like, well, we haven't seen him in a while. So I guess something's coming up with. Right.
Yeah, they're really cool. They're really cool. And actually, yeah, you've got to keep, you sort of pull moments out of the episodes as they lock. But then sometimes it's about what's coming up. It's more about what's coming up in the episode that influences what's in it. But also with Fleabag, it was a really good opportunity for me to try and be playful and inject some of the humor that was in the episodes so that the recaps had that as well. But yeah, some assistants try and steer away from the recaps. And sometimes when you're really busy, they can be a drag and another huge job. often people will ignore them until the very last minute and then start to give you feedback. And that can be really tricky if you're trying to get an episode over the line. But yeah. You have to do them. They're your way up.
With that season 2 trailer, that must have been challenging because, like, what an embarrassment of riches to, you know, so I'm sure sometimes people who like are cutting a trailer for a movie where it's like, okay, I know there's like 3 lines that are good in this movie and they're the ones that are going to get in the trailer. And this is such a, you know, every scene is a classic. So what was the challenge of finding the stuff to feature?
It was about energy. I know it was about energy and not revealing, trying to be true to the spirit of the show, which sounds really vague and ambiguous. But for example, initially there was, in my first cut, there was a moment with the counselor in it. And it felt like it was implying that the series was about Fleabag being in therapy. And I didn't feel like that was a truthful thing to trail an audience with, because the show isn't about that. And I thought it would, to have that in a trailer would give like a really strong indication about where the show might head, and it wasn't going in that direction. So it was about finding moments of fun that might reveal the depth, direction without giving anything away. And actually, I can't remember where I picked this up. I think it was at the film school that you were talking about earlier, but somebody told me once that often writing scripts is about selling the sizzle and not the steak. And I think that is a really good thing a really good thing to have in your mind when you're approaching things like trailers and recaps as well.
We have a listener question from Lorenzo on our Facebook group. And he asked, was there anything that's now considered an essential part of Fleabag, which, I mean, that's subjective, but to us, it's like everything. But is there anything that almost didn't make it into the final cut that you can think of? Was there like a line or scene that people weren't sure how it would read? And now you look back, you're like, oh my God, of course.
I think Gary might be the person to tap up about that. But I can't think of anything anyway. I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is some stuff, but...
Well, speaking of Gary.
Speaking of Gary, yeah, I often do.
were you part of the effort to add Dalnarav to the end without his knowledge?
No, I had no idea. So I was as surprised as him to find that out. That was all Phoebe, and what a lovely thing to do. And actually probably Harry as well, who's equally as lovely.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was nothing to do with me. So that what you do in the cutting room is you get it to... You sort of make all the editorial decisions, and then it goes to final post to do all the things like VFX and online and grade. So that happened in the online, I think.
I could imagine, especially for you guys who, like Gary said, see literally every frame of the show before it goes out. So not even just to see his name, but to be like, wait a minute, how'd that get in there?
Yeah, it was really cool. Such a cool thing to do. And actually, I'm on a few editor groups on Facebook and Twitter, and it just erupted. And Phoebe got loads of good press with editors off her. But actually, there was another moment in episode 4, which was another nice surprise. I mean, there are so many of them. Also, you don't really hear the music. Often you don't hear, especially as an assistant, sometimes you don't hear the music. So it was great to hear Isabel's score. But a really funny moment, which is possibly not funny for people who it wasn't a surprise for, but when Claire says, who's Stephanie, when she's on the phone to Fleabag in there. When Fleabag's in the cafe before she goes to see her new haircut, that had me in hysterics as somebody who didn't know it was coming.
I can imagine, because I love that bit, because it's just it's silly. It's just totally silly. And so as much as we loved it, I can't imagine how much you did, because you didn't even, you know, you thought you knew it was coming.
Yeah. Those moments are great when something takes you by surprise, and especially if it takes you somewhere moving or funny. They're really cool.
That's another one of those things that I didn't catch till like the third watch. because I was just focused on her getting out of the cafe or whatever. And so, and then also, don't bring Hillary.
Don't bring Hillary for some reason.
No, she just says it so matter of factly. No, don't bring her. Why would you bring her?
Well,
the other thing with Gary, I mean, it must have been exciting for you and your team to see him win the Emmy. Were you watching that ceremony, or how did you find out that he won?
Often I find out these things from Twitter. Just I'll remember that these ceremonies are happening. So I text him because I'd seen that he'd won. And he was like, I gave you a shout out, and everyone applauded. So that was nice.
That whole season for anybody who was working on Fleabag, I mean, it was just award after award after award. I mean, we've heard from people saying that it was just our little show. We didn't think it was going to be so big. I mean, what was your sense when you were working on it? Like, were you taken by surprise by the reaction to it?
I thought it was brilliant, but often my radar isn't 100% accurate. So there was a Wanderlust, which I was alluding to earlier, I thought was going to be a smash hit on BBC when it went out. But it sort of got pushed as a slightly different show to the one that it actually was. And there was a little bit of a backlash against it. As it turns out, it's now getting really popular on Netflix, which is great. But at the time, I was like, well, what's going on? I thought this show is a really brilliant show and really fantastically written and directed and edited. Everything about it was really cool. And I'm sure Fleabag fans would love it as well. So you never know. And I had this with Staged as well. You're like, well, I think this is really cool. And it's taken us to a place which is really satisfying, which is an understatement for Fleabag. But you can never tell how it's going to land with an audience. You don't know what's going on, you know, in the world at the time. You don't know what things are going to be in the news that are potentially going to turn people against things. So the moment that I realized that it was going to be, I knew it was really good, but because series one had been such a huge success across the board, there was that element for me of how is this going to be received. I thought it was as good as series one, possibly better. You just don't know how people are going to receive it. But there was a moment. So there was the cast and crew screening, which was also sort of combined with the press screening, and some fans were able to get tickets as well. So, and it was at the BFI, so this huge theatre in London by the south, on the South Bank. And obviously all the crew were there, and Gary and I sort of walked in and got a seat together, a couple of seats together. We weren't on the same seat.
Gary's just sitting on your lap.
I think I would be on his lap. So within 20 seconds, it was like being at a rock concert. It was just raucous laughter. And we only screened episode one as well, and it was just such electric energy. Gary and I just turned to each other and just smiled, and it was just an amazing experience to sort of be there. And then I was like, okay, this is gonna go down really well.
That must have felt incredible. That must have been a really cool moment.
You don't really get that in well, I've never experienced that. So yeah, it was fantastic. It's sort of one of those moments where you remember details of it. It was really cool. And afterwards there was a Q&A, and people were asking questions that they were really emotionally invested in. And you could just tell the sort of really strong, deep connections that some people had to it, and they'd responded really well to it.
One, what a great experience for you guys, because like you were saying, with, you know, a lot of film and TV production, you're just making it in a bit of a vacuum, and not, you know, like you said, making it to where you know you like it, but, and then a lot of times you don't even get to see that audience reaction. Because I know in the before times, my husband and I would go to a lot, like Comic-Con a lot, and we'd always hear actors and crew say, because they would do a screening of an episode, and actors would be like, I've never watched an audience watch it. Like, this is such a new experience.
Well, actually, Twitter is can be good for that if the reaction is good. On Staged, it was an amazing experience to see all the people responding on Twitter from a really early stage. Like when the teaser was released, there was huge action on Twitter. But it's not often you get, it's more of a theatre thing, isn't it, or a musical thing. So yeah, it was a really cool experience, especially for an assistant to go through that. And actually, it was great to have worked on it and not be somebody that's central to it. So you could just sort of melt into the background and just experience it going on around you. That was really cool.
Well, I'm so excited to get to stage, but we have one more very important question for you, Dan, which we know you're the brilliant assistant editor of Fleabag, but we also sort of think of you as the keeper of the blooper reel, potentially, which we know we will never see, but we just like, so Gary said there may or may not be a gag reel that you compiled. Can you confirm if it does or does not exist?
So sadly, I have to confirm that it does not exist. And the reason being, so normally as an assistant, that's another thing that you're keeping up with as the shoot goes along. But there was so much on Fleabag to be keeping up with that wasn't something that I was focusing on. And a request did come in at the last minute within like a few days before the wrap party. And I did send something across, but in the end, Phoebe wanted a scene from each of the performers in it, which there wasn't. So in the end, she just downloaded some of the assembled scenes and they showed those. So blooper reels, people are loving them. Like on stage, I often get a request, but there are, what people don't realize is they're sort of, they need to be signed off, but everyone needs, the directors, producers, actors that are in them need to okay them. So they're actually quite hard to release unless they're on a DVD or something like that. So I guess there was a blooper reel. Phoebe was the only person that ever saw it and she decided not to show it to anyone else. So
I thought you were going to say, well, these are all such professionals, there were no bloopers.
Well, there is that too. In fact, often on comedies, there aren't so many bloopers because the whole show is funny. It's often the drama shows which are the funnier moments to have on a blooper reel because everyone's been so serious and then something funny happens. You do find that sometimes on comedies. Just before we get off Fleabag, if that was where we were going.
Oh, yeah.
Go for it.
Please, tell us as much as you want.
I was talking to Gary the other day and he didn't believe me about this. And I've never told anybody involved in the show, apart from now him, because it is so twee and unbelievable. But we locked Fleabag really late one night, December 2018. And I lived just outside of London at the time. And as I walked from the cutting room to the station, a fox followed me all the way. And I've got pictorial evidence of it as well.
Get out.
What?
That's crazy.
Gary thought I was making it up to be twee. But it actually happened. It sort of, sometimes it would run ahead and then come back round. But yeah, it pretty much picked me up as soon as I left the cutting room. And
sort of, hallucinating right now.
And then it went on its merry way, sort of around Euston Way, and I boarded the train and just was like, what the fuck was that?
That's the appropriate response, I think.
And then the next job that I was on, there was a fox in that as well. It was all a bit trippy.
That is so nuts. That's wild. That's cool, though. That's a nice little bookend, you know? It's like, all right.
Often you find things like that, little serendipitous things that relate to the show or life imitating art to end on another pretentious note. But I'll send you the picture as proof so you can...
Please.
Please do.
We're hardcore journalists, so we'll require that.
Yeah, of course.
And if the blooper reel makes it in the email, that's great.
Is there anything else that, you know, you knew we were talking about Fleabag, and I'm sure we'll still throw Fleabag questions in the next few minutes. But, you know, anything else that we didn't ask you that you wanted to make sure you mentioned or that you thought, you know, while you were watching this morning, like, oh, the ladies will like hearing about this.
The ladies.
The ladies.
only that Phoebe, Harry and Sarah and Lydia were just the most generous and lovely collaborators and really did like a huge amount for me and my career as an editor. That they were just really great to work with.
So Staged, we had been aware of Staged and obviously had seen you tweeting about it and hadn't realized it was actually available in the US. Season 1 is on Hulu. And so I finally watched it and then also used the VPN to watch season two on iPlayer. I'm now obsessed with Stage.
Good. That's great to hear.
I love it so much. And I, the whole time watching, I'm like, Dan Gage, you are the hero of Staged, because this entire show depends on the edit. It's like found footage, even though it's obviously all scripted. But I guess for people who don't know what Staged is, can you describe what Staged is?
Yeah, so Staged was a show that was set in the first British lockdown. And it was about sort of two actors, David Tennant and Michael Sheen, coming to terms with the fact that they are having to stay in their house and isolate from the world. And it was about all the existential questions that came with that and the comedic situations that arose from them having to communicate with everybody remotely on Zoom or FaceTime. The premise for the story is that a young director was about to get his big break on a theatre production, Simon Evans, played by Simon Evans. And the story is that he tries to get David and Michael to rehearse on Zoom. And through that, we then get to meet their agent, played by Nina Sosonia, and other actors that they're either casting or using to sort of manipulate whoever they want to manipulate in the show. It's really good fun, and kept me busy during lockdown, very busy, and was really a really amazing thing to watch go out and have people respond to. So in short, that is what Staged is.
How did you get involved, and when did Simon Evans come up with the idea? Because it seemed like it started pretty quickly after lockdown started.
So actually there's a very strong Fleabag connection to this, which you may not be aware of. So initially they approached Gary, and Gary was at the time working on a Disney film with my wife, who is now Gary's assistant. And so occasionally I'd pop up in the background and try and distract Gary while Charlotte was assisting him. And we'd sort of chat every now and then. And one night he was like, this producer that I've worked with has approached me about a lockdown comedy. I don't think there were any people involved at the time. And so that was early April. So it was quite soon. It was around a month after lockdown started in the UK. Probably sooner than that, actually. Lockdown was around March 9th. March the 16th, somewhere around then. So yeah, it was actually 2 or 3 weeks. And I just started to kick around, obviously having made shorts and with nothing to do, I just started to kick around some incredibly inferior ideas about something that I could do to sort of be creative during the lockdown. So, and it came in at the same sort of time. And actually during that same week, two other people approached me with similar ideas, and I had to just pick one. People that I would normally have loved to work with, but I was like, if I can't really involve myself with discussions in case they have similar ideas, it's just unfair on them all and me. Yeah. So I think when I first spoke to Simon and Finn, there was talk of approaching David and then approaching Michael. I think that was where they were. But yeah, quite early.
That must have been a lot. Like, once you got into it, you know, people talk about like Zoom fatigue, which we're all very, very conscious of. You must be the king of Zoom fatigue, because not only probably were you, I'm assuming you had Zoom production meetings, but then your literal job is to edit Zoom footage. So what, you know, are you so over the video side of this pandemic?
I don't think so. I think Simon is probably the most Zoom exhausted. Everything was shot over Zoom, so he was on it all day. And actually, when he was available, my Zoom would be open for him to log in whenever he could. So there was a time where I would be on Zoom for sort of 14, 15 hours a day, 7 days a week. So that was exhausting. But actually, there are obviously huge disadvantages to editing this way. But being able to screen a cut in a Zoom room like this, and at the same time have a direct angle on the director's face, is really useful, especially on a comedy, because you can see the moments they're hitting for him.
interesting.
So normally they're sat behind you, so you don't get to see their initial reaction to things. So in some ways, in many ways, it's good to be in the room with them, but in some ways, having them on Zoom like this is really useful. So there are advantages of working this way, but you're on it for hours and hours at a time. And also feeling like you're spending so long cutting David and Michael, you feeling like you've got a Zoom relationship with them.
Well, that's how I felt. By the end of it, I was like, I feel like I spent my lockdown with David Tennant and Michael Sheen. You do start to feel there's an intimacy to it.
There's definitely an intimacy. And actually, since series two went out, I've been thinking about this quite a lot. I think in a really profound way, that is part of the charm. I don't think we'll ever be in a position again where the audience is communicating with performers in the same way that they're communicating with everyone in their real lives. So the intimacy is exactly the same for an audience and David and Michael as it is to the audience with their family. So I think that's something that is really, and we weren't aware of that, and I'm not even sure if that's true, but it's something that I sort of stumbled on as a thought a couple of weeks ago and have been trying to sort of articulate. And I think there is something about that that's made it such, initially we shot with phones as well as on the Zoom screens, and I pushed for that when we were first discussing it, because I was like, we're not going to want to see these emotional shifts on a Zoom screen. We're going to want to see them in proper, you know, with a proper shot that looks like it's been designed. But when they came in, the intimacy of the Zoom, of them looking directly down the camera was so immediate and effective and emotional. It was, you were so emotionally connected to them and their experience, which was the same experience that the audience was going through. They very quickly became obsolete, and we only then used them for moments away from the computer. So for David and Georgia, and I think Simon and Lucy. But yeah, I definitely think there's something in that sort of the fourth wall being broken in a way that is indistinguishable from audience performer and audience, how they're interacting with other people. I think there's something interesting about that.
Yeah. I thought it was fun too, how even using the frame of the Zoom window to make some jokes, like when he's talking to Jim Parsons and he's just like half asleep in the corner. And he's like, I can't even see you. Like, or you know, playing with what's in the background. And then those breakaway shots were good, because I'm sure they gave you also some kind of visual interest. And as a viewer, there was a little kind of relief of Zoom fatigue, because you would have these kind of cutaways.
Yeah, and also they were sort of, we were trying to place different periods of the pandemic or the UK experiences so that it wasn't just two actors moaning about, it was never this, but we wanted to help that as much as possible so that it didn't just feel like two actors moaning about being in lockdown. And they were about trying to reflect, what we were trying to do there was reflect the emotion and the experiences of the situation back at the audience. And we've sort of used them, not in a chronological way, but in a kind of emotional way, so that it would relate to the emotion of the episode or the story of the episode. For example, NHS clapping and the sirens comes quite late on in the series, but actually happened quite early in the timeline of the pandemic. It was about using the tools that we had and in a playful to just try and enhance the experience. And it's things like the titles and the way that we cut between shots as well. And what I really loved the scenes where, because they almost felt like little theatre productions going on in everyone's room, where David and Michael would get up off their chairs and be walking around. They were the really fun scenes for me. And so it was about just using the tools, because ultimately we only had one shot from each character to tell the story. So it was about pulling as many tools as we could into the show to try and use them to be playful with or enhance the emotional experience, anything that we could use to help to tell the story.
Or even just the effect of like someone just disappearing, like that little boop and then they're gone.
Yeah, and we tried to do that in different ways as well. And sometimes we had to because of the footage that we had. But it always brings a different energy to it when someone pops up out of nowhere. Often we did find a different way to do that as we went through in series two. The people coming in are doing it in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was all good fun trying to find those moments.
Yeah, as we're talking, I'm waiting for like some major celebrity to just like pop up. So who have you booked? Who have you booked, Dan?
I can send the link to Simon if you want him to pop up.
Perfect. Sure. We have a voicemail question from Anna. I know it's a question you guys get a lot, but we were also interested in this.
Hi, my question for Dan is about Staged. And I think it was a really creative piece of TV and it was perfect for lockdown. And my understanding is that Michael and David are quite good pals in real life. So I wondered if it wasn't actually that tightly scripted. Was there quite a bit of improvisation in their banter between the two of them? And did that make for quite a tricky editing job, because did you have quite a lot to choose from and find yourself having to make judgments on what were the funniest bits of dialogue? I'd love to know more about the process of how that script came about and what that was like for you editing afterwards. Thank you
Anna, that's a really interesting question. I should start with saying that Simon wrote some incredibly textured and layered scripts for both series, and he was and he kept rewriting them as well, because he would meet with the people involved and then infuse his script with those meetings. So he'd be constantly updating them and making them better. And then David and Michael would improvise around them in a way that was brilliant. And so the schedule for series one was so fast. So by the time we got to, I think, episode four, we had 2 days from the start of the shoot to lock. So there would be times where Simon would come and view the first cut and I'd be like, I'm really sorry, mate. I haven't even edited the scripted stuff because the improvisation, the improv stuff was so brilliant that we don't have time to sort of watch the full assembly and make those measured decisions. It's just, this is the stuff that's got that I think has got the best energy here. We've just got to go with that and get it done. So he was really gracious about that and trusting me that my instinct was correct on that. But yeah, so much footage and, but not a chore, but a challenge. But it was an amazing experience. That's the stuff that is really good for you as an editor to have, search for moments of magic that will elevate the show. And so that was the stuff that I was really interested in finding. So I'd spend most of my time, well, that's not strictly true, I'd spend huge amounts of time watching everything really thoroughly and pulling every moment that moved me, made me laugh, made me feel anything, and just building the show that way. So my first cuts would be 2 or 3 times the length that ultimately the scene would be. And then also you want, because there's 2 people on screen at the time for most of it, you want to get all the great reactions in as well. So sometimes you pull in a reaction from a different take or a different moment and things like that. And then of course you have to make sure that it runs without a jump. So it was tricky. But the beauty of it was that there was so much comedy everywhere. Every scene was just full of it. There's scripted comedy in it. The moments where they were just reacting to the absurdity of the situation was funny. There was comedy just infused in it. So for me, it was about trying to find the best way to make the story resonate, because I knew that the comedy was there. And that's from the performances and the relationships between the characters and the script. So, it was hard work to edit it, and huge amounts of hours. I've never worked so many hours on a job in such a short amount of time, but it was all about supporting what was there and finding the most the way to make the story resonate in the most effective way was the approach that I took to it. Yeah. It was a challenge, but also it was such good fun. And every there are moments on series two, there was a moment right at the start that had me in hysterics for about 10 minutes. Charlotte's got a video of me uncontrollably laughing. And that didn't even make my first assembly because I then found a moment that was even funnier. Wow. So it was just that it was just infused with such hilarity that that it was really joyful to be sort of having these really absurd relationships with people who don't know you, but it was a challenge but great fun as well.
Yeah.
What would you say is the percentage of how much got shot versus how much ended up in the show?
That's a really difficult question without me being mathematical about it. But
the other production question I had was, were all of the scenes, were they shot together where they were talking to each other, or were there ever just one actor talking kind of just to the camera and then you cut it to look like they were having a conversation?
So recording like this, sometimes the technology fails, but initially Simon would log on with Zoom and we'd use a little piece of freeware software to record each person's camera. So that I was able to have two different video streams, or five if we went up to five characters. They were always performing with each other, and there is no way that I could make those connections so strong between them if they'd have been performing individually.
Yeah.
That's just something that is inherent in the rushes. You can enhance it, but I would never have been able to create that. So there was one scene in series two, the Jim Parsons scene, where David, there were a number of scenes where some people's cameras would fail, often Simon's, because he was using his laptop so much that it would overheat. But there was one, this, I was astounded with David, because in the Jim Parsons scene, spoilers for the Americans, in the Jim Parsons scene, his camera had not recorded properly. So I'd sort of pieced together the scene according to Jim's performances and David's audio, but then had to give that back to David to re-record his performance. And what he sent back was just perfectly timed with no mistakes. I was thinking this is going to be a real chore for David to record this learn the pace of it, record it with an actor that's not performing with him while he's lying on a chair. But he sent it back within 20 minutes and it was all timed perfectly. And it was a brilliant performance. And he was really great.
Really great. Yeah. You'd never know.
You wouldn't know that. No, not at all.
Did you ever run into issues with like audio delay where the timing maybe it was thrown off because there was a gap?
Yes. There's a really boring technical answer for this. But the most problematic thing for this was the Zoom loop back. So unless people are wearing headphones, you have their dialogue as they're speaking, and then you have their dialogue looping back through the other person's camera and microphone. So that was hours of work. So my approach to that was, so Fiona Starogardsky, who came on board on series one as assistant and was brilliant, she, part of her job was to group everything together so that I could listen to it with one person's dialogue, because everything's running on slightly different times. So yeah, it was a massive technical challenge. I mean, nothing about the show was standard. Everything was a totally new experience and we had to feel our way through everything. But that was the most time consuming thing. One of the most time consuming things, because there were just so many levels to it. So she would have to group things together. And later Charlotte assisted me on series two, who did an equally brilliant job. So they had to piece them together. And then I would do a really rough assembly and then have to send it back to them so that they could then cut out all the looped back audio so that I could then watch something that sounded like it very sounded closer to how it ultimately was. So without getting too technical, yeah, it was a massive challenge, that audio.
That's unbelievable. And yeah. See, it's so funny because it has the illusion of like, oh, this must have been easy because they just did it over Zoom. They just had to record like we do. Like, I didn't even think about the loopback with the sound.
Yeah, and but also, I was really nervous that the quality of the footage wouldn't be good enough at the start, and ultimately I was trying to do some tests. Ultimately, we had to just get moving because we thought the pandemic was going to be over in 6 weeks, so we were desperately trying to get something out while it was relevant. But the audio as well, the quality of the audio. Normally, you get a dedicated director of photography as well, but the quality of the audio I was concerned about, because sometimes, particularly in the scenes where David and Georgia were quite far away from the camera, sometimes their dialogue would be really low, but the sound mixers did a really incredible job at on-site, leveling everything out and sort of, I don't know what they do, but making it sound pleasurable and on an equal level, they did a really good job. That was something that I thought would cripple us. Yeah. But yeah, ultimately they were able to work with it. So
did they have lighting too?
I think David and Georgia did.
Yeah.
And some of the performers I think would have ring lights.
Right.
Some of the guests.
Because some of the video quality is incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody told, actually I had a call from someone about another Zoom production, and they were saying that they'd spoken to one site who said on some occasions they had to degrade the quality of footage because it didn't look like Zoom material,
yeah,
which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, we've talked some about the technical differences between shooting something like this and editing something like this and, you know, the before times. But what was it like for you when I was watching, and I think this is why stage has really taken off so well, is that we were all going through the same or some similar variation of the same thing at the same time. And you got it out so quickly that it was like the closest thing to a reality show that we could get. Cause you're like watching, you know, I enjoyed watching them. Maybe enjoyed isn't the right word, but it felt satisfying to watch them sort of devolve. And, you know, to watch Michael Sheen's, you know, mane grow and to watch them just sort of slip into the abyss and in the wondering and the desperation. Like, I mean, I remember Christy and I were on the same page a lot about almost a year ago. It was like the fear and the uncertainty and just like, what is happening? That was so overwhelming. And you're like watching this happen to other people. What was it like for you as you were going through the same thing that you were sort of making fun of, but also commenting on? Like, what did it feel like being behind the scenes for that?
That is a good question. So as soon as I started on stage, lockdown was sort of something that was just happening in the background because it just required all of my attention. So it was actually a really good thing. I went from having nothing to do, having lost the job that I was working on, to being thrown into something that I could contribute to. So when I first spoke to Simon, he and Finn had put together a pitch document. Considering this was their first, I think Simon has only ever, he's directed loads of brilliant theatre, but he was about to direct his first film, but he's never before directed anything in TV or on screen. And considering that, he put together a pitch document where everything was totally clear. And as I was turning the pages, I was, the tone, the sort of, the atmosphere that they wanted was really succinctly articulated, so that by the time I got to the end of it, I was sort of I was saying, oh, this sounds like The Trip, or this sounds like Sideways. And then I would turn over a page and it would be, we are referencing The Trip and we're referencing Time. So really quickly, he just sold it in a way that I was able to, and I've spoken to Alex Baranowski about this. We were both able to really get on board with the direction that we were heading in, which was great, because then we could sort of bring our own interpretation of that to the table, which would allow him to go and focus on other things. So we were, and he was very clear that he didn't want it to be about the weight of the situation. And Finn was very clear about this as well. They didn't want to mention it. I think it was only mentioned once in series one, in a comedic way. So they didn't want to, see masks. They didn't want to hear about coronavirus. So we were sort of focusing on the absurdity and the sort of lightness of it, or the light in the shade. So there's and we were fortunate in an odd way to have the weight of a terribly dark situation running through it, which enabled us to just look for the lightness in it and find the absurdity and the surreal. So in a way, it's sort of, and at first I was having those things that they talk about in series one, where I'd have odd dreams and sleepless nights. And I was getting that. And then when I started working on it, that went away because I had something to focus on. So in terms of the situation, it probably helped. And also it helped that the tone that we were going for was about finding moments of relief from it in that situation.
That's a great segue, because I was going to ask about Alex Baranowski and working with him on the music and how the music influenced your edit. Because it's funny, I felt like the show didn't totally gloss over, though, maybe it was less about like the weight of people dying in the pandemic and more about like the mental experience of going through this, like the kind of just the human experience of feeling these feelings. And because I felt like, again, similar to what I was saying about Fleabag season one, like when staged kind of became deeper for me was the plot line with Michael Sheen's neighbor and him being genuinely worried about her, and that being rooted in comedy about why he even was had a relationship with her. But then I don't know, it just felt like it did add a little depth to the humor. So what I guess you kind of did answer that about the conversations about the tone, kind of striking between acknowledging why they're in this situation, but also the comedy of it.
Yeah, well, I think if we'd have led with something like that, it would have been a totally different experience for an audience. But and these are the shows that I like. These are the comedy shows that I like. You're taking the audience in one direction, and then it's like the tickle tickle slap thing that Phoebe talks about. You're leading them in one direction, and then you just very subtly take their hand to a different door, which gives you an emotional kick or a laugh from darkness or something. So I think the lightness, yeah, and absolutely, it did need the weight of the situation, which was inherent in it. And Simon was really smart in just sort of going there very softly, but for it to affect the people that we had, that we were experiencing it with. But there was a real lightness of touch in the writing of that and the performance of it from all of them. In that scene when the ambulance comes as well, that's one of my favourite scenes in the whole series. Mm-hmm. All of them, Anna, Georgia, and the comedy in that is so brilliant as well. Mm-hmm. Michael, Georgia popping up on Michael's meeting when he didn't know he was there. And that's one of those scenes where everyone's sort of running off screen as well, which adds drama and tension.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. It did. It couldn't have just been a comedy without the weight, but also it would. People have come to me and said that they need that was it was what we needed during that time. So I think looking for those moments of light and sort of humour and absurdity were really good for us working on it, but also hopefully the people that watched it too.
Well, and I think too for what you mentioned about Simon's scripts being very layered. Because those scenes also allowed for some status shift between David and Michael. Because for a lot of it, it felt like Michael was kind of the alpha and David was the beta. But then in those scenes, you kind of saw vulnerability in Michael and David was the one comforting him. Like I just liked seeing that kind of ping pong between the two of them.
Yeah, I think he really cleverly manipulated their shifts. And also when you get onto series two as well, there are more shifts, but even within scenes that would change. And even though that things were improvised, the only way that you can do that and tell a story is by having a script that creates a structure. And Simon did a really great job on that. And Finn as well. I think Finn contributed. And also David and Michael, I think were heavily, I wasn't really involved in those discussions, but I think they were quite heavily involved with that, with the writing. He's a really smart writer, Simon.
Oh, yeah.
Had you worked with David or Michael before?
Yes, actually. So not Michael. So I was really excited to work with him. But I was the assistant editor on Broadchurch Series 3, because that's important. And David was obviously brilliant in that. David, I'd worked with before. Phoebe, obviously, I've worked with before. I think that's everyone.
Now you got quite a much longer list.
Amazing. I was saying to people that less than a year into my editing career, and I've peaked. The only way is down from here. Sam Jackson, Judy Dench, Phoebe and Kate. I'm never going to be in a situation where I'm cutting all of those people, you know, cutting all of those brilliant actors on the same show again.
No, certainly not. What was it like? I saw on Twitter, you tweeted a while ago about the text between you and Simon when he confirmed that Samuel Jackson was going to be on it. What was it like to get that tweet? I mean, that text.
One of the most bizarre moments of my life. Like, we had another brilliant thing about this show was we had no idea. Like, we made the pilot with nobody knew about it. Normally a pilot gets commissioned, so nobody knew about it. We had no aspirations that this was going to even get picked up. Everyone was working for free. We were just passing the time and trying to make something good. So there'd been no discussion about where this might head, or at least no discussion that I was involved with. So each time, especially on series one, each time we locked an episode, the new episode would come in and I would be experiencing that for the first time as an audience would. Mm. So I had no idea that we even had the ambition to go that big. I thought it would be sort of friends of David or friends of Simon, of people that he'd worked with in the theatre. So then he just dropped that text on me out of nowhere in the morning when I was making breakfast. And it was just, the thrill was incredible. It was an amazing experience. There were sort of two or three moments that were really just amazing that you wouldn't ever get as an editor normally. So there was that, there was sort of, having the initial response when David and Michael and Georgia and Anna said they wanted to continue and move forward with it. That was really cool as well. And then when the trailer went out and the huge eruption on Twitter about it, they were really cool moments that you just think, wow, this is going to be massive. But yeah, Sam was one of those.
He was awesome. How did you guys, I mean, how did you get so many of those? I mean, well, first of all, I guess, when did you hear there was going to be a season two? And then how did Simon start lining up this murderer's row of guest stars?
I think just, so season two, we'd sort of joked we were going to progress to a series two. And we discussed it quite early. And there was never really a it's going ahead moment. I think they just went down traditional routes, maybe with agents of, actors that were involved in the show already. I know Phoebe, they approached her agent. Yeah, I think all via agents. And obviously, as David says in series two, people were sitting around looking for something to do. Yeah. So, and it helped with the success of series one that we could take something to them and show them.
Yeah.
And actually, Finn sent a really gracious text after the news of Sam broke that said, it was a team effort. He saw the pilot. He saw the scripts. This wasn't just us pitching to him. This was everyone who's worked on it, earning the involvement of this amazing A-list Hollywood actor. So
wow.
That was really cool. Yeah.
Well, then that probably helps set wheels in motion. Then you get Judy Dench. So when you approach Jim Parsons and you say Judy Dench did it, like, it's hard for him to go pass. Like
right.
Yeah, I wasn't involved in those discussions. I would occasionally throw a name into the ring. That all happened with Victor, who is the other producer, and Finn. I mean, there are a number of exec producers as well, but I think they were the people involved in casting.
No disrespect to Jim Parsons, by the way.
I think absolutely. Jim was brilliant, wasn't he?
He was so funny. The part that made me laugh out loud it was when, I mean, I could just sit here and quote it all day, but when David's like, have you read the script? He's like, have you? I don't think we're on the same page here.
Yes, and every guest brought really interesting idiosyncrasies, and Jim's sort of clicking of the pen and his sort of bemusement at David was something that we were trying to lean into in the edit. That episode, I think that was the episode, that's the episode with Josh as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
5, 6, and 7 in series 2 are my favourite episodes, I think. But the weird thing was, as we were locking them, we were saying, well, this is our new favorite.
They did. They kept getting better and better. Well, and then how did, I mean, I don't know if maybe you were, know this answer, but to decide who was going to play themselves and who played characters, because like Whoopi Goldberg and Ben Schwartz both were playing characters, not, I mean, versus themselves. I guess maybe that was just kind of how it was scripted.
Yeah, I think they would have been conversations between Simon and Finn. That wasn't really anything that I was involved in. But I guess the rule is the agencies were playing roles and the guests who were involved in the production or in either production played versions of themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's the rule. Yeah, I think that is the rule.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I was telling Allie, just as a side note, that again, I mentioned The Stand, which Whoopi Goldberg has been in. I said, it's always so nice to be reminded of what a great actor she is, because I think people just know her from The View, a lot of maybe younger people. She's just so funny and her timing's just razor sharp.
Yeah, really great. She, in fact, most of them, in fact, probably all of them, you could just tell from watching the Zoom recordings that Simon's would send over, that moments that would just zing. And as long as you were able to get to those moments, the scene would be brilliant. And so they shot her quite early on in series 2, and it was a real confidence boost, because similar to Fleabag, in that you're like, okay, we're doing something different with this. People love series 1. How's this going to be? So it was really reassuring to see those scenes with Whoopi come over and to see those moments that to calm everyone down and be like, okay, yeah, this is going to be fun.
Yeah.
Did those actors have leeway to improvise?
Yeah, everyone. So Simon was really gracious in that he would send the scripts to everybody and invite them to contribute if they wanted to change things. So he was forever rewriting everything as we were going along. And I think in series 2, though most of the improvisation came from obviously David, Michael, Georgia and Anna and Ben as well. Some of the more acerbic lines that she would end phone calls with, there would be like 5 or 6 different versions of those that would be fun to try and play with and see which ones work the best.
Nice. I love Ben Schwartz. I just adore him. And I also enjoyed that in the background of his, you know, little Zoom background, you could see the middle ditch in his character's room, you could see the middle ditch and Schwartz posters.
Some free advertising there for Ben.
But and it must have been felt really cool to get a Python, to get Michael Palin.
Everyone was really excited about that.
Legendary.
Wow. He looks so good. He's like 79.
Wow.
I didn't know he was 79. Yeah, he's a really nice energy. And everyone loves him. So it was good to see him in a slightly different light as well.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of cameos.
So the most important cameo. So I guess we're just embracing the spoilers here.
I think
we have to, don't we?
I was going to say, are you comfortable with that?
Well, otherwise we'd just be here not saying anything, right?
Right.
Also, this one got posted across all the Fleabag Phoebe Instagrams.
True. I had already seen it. So, yeah. So, you know, spoiler for anybody who hasn't realized it yet, but Phoebe is in series 2, episode 7, the monologue woman.
Ben Schwartz. So,
I love that.
That was an improvised line, actually.
Was it really?
Of course.
The monologue woman.
He called her a few other things as well that I can't repeat. All of them nice, obviously.
Oh, I'm sure. So yeah, talk a little about, I mean, I know it's not your job as in the casting thing, but when you learned Phoebe was going to be a part of it, or when you were part of those discussions, what was that like just to know, oh, I'm going to be working with an old friend now?
It was great. So I mean, I'd mentioned Phoebe to Simon in series one, right at the end of series one, after I found out about Judy. And he was like, I've got a thought about her for later. So, but yeah, it was really exciting. I obviously cut recaps and trailers, but I'd never had the pleasure of editing her in full scenes. And she was brilliant and really funny. And it was great to bring her into this world and try and cut her Zoom footage.
Yeah. Did Simon write her little bit with David, or how much did she contribute to the writing at all? Or was that?
I know that Simon, I don't know actually, because by this stage, the scripts were sort of, the scripts were coming my way, but I'd sort of have a little look at them, send some thoughts.
Yeah.
Simon did offer her the opportunity to contribute. I don't know how much she did. She did improvise, as everyone did a little, you know, on the day. Yeah. So it was a combination, I think. But yeah, all that stuff about Simon and Phoebe working together previously is true.
Oh, is it? I was going to ask.
And actually we were sort of having a conversation about whether, you know, how much she remembered him and things like that. So I think all of that was going on in his head, probably not to the same extent. But he would do that. He would write in things. I think the semicolon thing in an email thing came from an email that I might have sent.
Oh, funny. And
mooting an idea.
Yeah.
So he would just draw from the situation and the people that he was talking to in a really clever way.
Oh, brilliant.
So she wasn't actually a Lou recluse.
I can't confirm or deny that.
No, I was going to say, I looked up Like a Fishbone, and the Guardian review, it is from 2010, and the Guardian review referred to a growingly impressive Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
So good. I did the same thing when the rushes came in. I was like, what's this play then? So yeah, I did the same thing. They had good foresight.
Well, and I also then looked up, because the play that she and Andrew Scott had done, Roaring Trade, was the year before, in 2009, and that critic said something else, like an increasingly acknowledging like an emerging talent or something. So I was like, okay, some people, she brought it early.
Right.
Yeah. Also, some very fastidious viewers had noted that Simon Evans directed Andrew Scott in The Dazzle.
I was just about to say that, actually. Yeah.
That poster was up on his background at his sister's house.
Which is actually his mum and dad's house.
Oh, funny.
Simon was tweeting about that play this morning. I think it's an anniversary or something of The Dazzle.
Oh, funny.
I was half expecting Andrew to rock up actually in an episode.
I thought the same thing. I was like, if he knows him, come on.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that was something they explored. I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe he was unavailable. Anyway, so back to staged,
mm-hmm.
off of Andrew Scott. So were there any? I mean, you said there were so many highlights from it. Were there any? Whether it's one of the guest stars or an improvised line that surprised you, that really felt special or relatable or a standout moment from it?
Yeah, there's so many of those. In series one, the sort of homeschooling stuff with David and Michael, the Scottish screaming, all of the stuff that they were riffing on that was about the experiences that everyone was going through. All of that was just finding the best improvised moments of those. There were sort of moments of magic that you'd be looking at rushes that were scripted or versions of the script, and then all of a sudden, there would be like something that would collide between them, the chemistry, and they would just go somewhere completely different. And so those were really great moments for an editor. They're the things that you're looking for. Obviously, I really love Nina. I thought Nina was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And so much of it resonated because you were going through it as well, or you knew people that were going through it, especially series one that was so accessible for everyone. Series two was spun into a slightly different direction, but also the guest stars in that run of series two, five, six, and seven, Ken and Ewan, Christoph, and Hugh Bonneville. So yeah. Everyone approached it with their own idiosyncrasies, pushed for comedy or pushed for drama. But my favorite episode, I think, is series 2, episode 6, or series 2, episode 7. I love Georgia running around piecing everyone together again after the fallout from ep 5. I'm just getting slightly confused about the episodes because originally that all of those guests in 5 and 6 was supposed to be one episode.
We
split them out into two. But I really loved the subtle shifts in the form that we'd established. So starting with Georgia and Anna was really fun. And then having David and Michael falling out and not talking to each other. And then having Georgia piece it together by bollocking Simon and then dragging David out of the cupboard. All of that was a really, really fun way, really fun direction to take it before we brought everyone back together again for the final two episodes.
Is there a season 3 or are we done?
Simon has spoken about maybe a special. So I don't know if that's something that he's working on. It depends what happens with the pandemic.
Right.
The good thing is that you can sort of, if everyone's in this situation, you can use it to reflect back on what people are going through, as long as it's a slightly different experience. It's obviously captivating to have David and Michael and the guests and Anna and Georgia and Lucy and Simon performing in this way. Maybe a special would be fun. Maybe something reflecting back on it afterwards could be fun.
Right.
I'm speculating here. Yeah. But when things get back to normal.
I just want to continue watching Michael Sheen and David Tennant's lives. Friendship.
That has become something that I wasn't aware that people were so fascinated with in an almost voyeuristic way, just everything about their lives. There are people on Twitter, and I consider some of these people almost friends, given the situation that we're in, and they're people that I read their tweets every day almost. And for them, they're just obsessed with everything that they can get from David and Michael. It's really amazing. And they're so cool about it. They give them the content that they want. And Michael set up a charity, I think, to sort of harness that fandom and turn it into something bigger than it was. And they've just actually one of the fans, in fact, I think all of the people involved in the charity are fans from Twitter. And actually one of them did an edit for a recent launch, which was really cool to see. So she did it in a stage style.
Wow.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, because I think both of them brought fandoms before, because that, you know, between Good Omens and obviously David with Doctor Who, these are already rabid fandoms. So to kind of feel like, oh my God, I get to spend, like, kind of like Ben Schwartz, we get to just hang out.
Yeah.
Like, just really hang out.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that was something that they intentionally tapped into, but everyone just sort of switched to stage, which was really cool for us.
Great. One other little question we want to ask, who is Rebecca Gage?
At first I was like, oh, is that his wife calling in off stage? But then I think you said your wife's name is not Rebecca. So.
No, so Rebecca is my sister. So she has a little acting academy up here in the Midlands, acting and singing. We had a really low budget and I was trying to pull favors. So I was calling her and saying, look, can you just give me some temp? And I was throwing her some lines, and some of them ended up, and Simon was sort of like, I mean, he could have kicked off and brought his own friends in, but he was really cool about just saying, no, I like it. She's good. And some of the lines that I was throwing her way ended up in it as well. So, yeah, that was fun. And it was fun for her to do as well, because she's got two young kids. And so lockdown could have got quite tough. So it brought a different energy for her to throw herself into. Actually, my nephews, there are some paintings in windows in one of the episodes. So they're from them. So, yeah, we were just pulling stuff from wherever we could.
That's so great.
Oh, I love that. So now we've solved the mystery of Rebecca. So we like to ask this final question to everybody that we interview. Looking back at Fleabag and/or staged or both, what are one of the standout moments that sticks with you? Like, what are the stories you're going to tell your grandkids or tell? You know, what's going to stay with you for a long time?
It's difficult with stage because none of us have ever met, so there aren't those moments that we had on Fleabag where you can sort of get together and celebrate it.
Right.
And I've probably touched on them already, that the screening of Fleabag at the BFI. A really funny thing about that is, inside of obviously the cast and crew, loads of women in their 20s and 30s, loads of women in their 20s and 30s, walked outside with Phoebe, just sort of behind Phoebe and Harry when we were going to a bar somewhere. And there's just like loads of middle-aged men wanting Phoebe's autograph. So what is going on? And then I later twigged that they were Star Wars fans. Oh. So she's got all the fandoms.
Oh, that is so fun. I was like, what? Why?
Yeah, I was like, oh, Fleabag is like got a really broad appeal, which it actually does.
Right.
But I didn't realize that the middle-aged men would be this obsessive about this show.
Oh, that is.
I don't say that disparagingly. I'm approaching a middle-aged man myself now. In answer to your question, before you wrap up, probably the Fleabag cast and crew screening, and the whole experience of stage is just mad. Nothing like anything I've experienced in any television show. And to see it go out and all those moments that I've talked about the sort of escalation of ambition and different guest stars coming in. And then just to see the reaction on Twitter and from everybody is probably the best experience from stage. And obviously to be involved with it. Oh, personally as well, I got nominated and won an award for it as well, which is amazing in my first year as an editor.
Amazing. Congratulations. Congratulations.
Lots of cool stuff has come off here. Thank you.
That's huge. That's awesome.
Oh, I love it. This has been so awesome, Dan. I can't thank you enough for taking so much time. We were like, oh, we usually take about an hour. And I don't know why we said that. That's a flat out lie. We're over two now.
I haven't spoken to anyone for this long for like well over a year, apart from Simon.
So we're in great company. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'll take that.
Well, thank you so much. And
my pleasure. It's been really good fun.
We love the show. We love both shows. And so now we can't wait to see what you do next, because I think you have the golden touch.
I'm just, it's all about the rushes. You just try and support it and get out of the way as an editor. So, but thank you. I'm glad you think that.
Well, thanks so much, Dan.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I always imagine this part, like, have you ever heard ads when there used to be comedy clubs, or when there used to be comedy clubs you could go to?
Yes.
And I always would love the VO announcer has to pretend they've just heard the joke. So it'll be like, Bob LaFrancisco this weekend at the Punchline. And then you'll hear like, what is it with guys and girls that they're different? And then he's like, ha, 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 Bob LaFrancisco this weekend. Like, that's how I feel doing these, because we haven't actually just listened to the interview, but then we're like, ha, 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 so much fun to talk to Dan.
We just loved it.
Yeah, but really, because I think we should use this.
I know.
So cool to talk to Dan. And I all those interviews, I always, and I told him this, I was like, the 10 minutes before they sign on, I'm so nervous. And I'm always like, oh my God, why did we do this? Why did we do this? I hope he cancels. I hope he calls and is like, guys, I am violently ill. And I'm like, oh my God, you know? No, and I was like, and then as soon as they sign on, I'm like, oh, this is fun. And yes. I've been looking forward to this all week.
Yes.
And so then he was so sweet, because he goes, well, that's exactly how I felt.
I know. Like, fuck, why did I say yes to this? It's the anticipatory stress.
Because the two of us, exactly. Well, and then I always get so scared. And see, I hate phone calls in general, because at least with Zoom, you can see the person and you can kind of react to facial expressions. But I'm just always afraid they're going to hate me. I have this like phone insecurity.
Girl, I do too. I didn't know you did. I'm terrible I never call. If I have to call someone, it takes a while.
It's part of the reason I didn't become an actual journalist, because the idea of cold calling somebody scares the shit out of me.
Me too!
Because I just assume I'm interrupting them.
Me too!
You know, of course, now you can schedule phone calls. But in the past, when it would be like, I'm just going to like ring someone up and be like, because I worked at a PR, I did an internship at a PR agency. And so you're like calling these random reporters in like Columbus, Ohio. You're like,
hey, so we have a story about caregivers, if you would be interested in covering, you know, and like they have, and we know what it's like where you've got like 50 things to do.
Yeah.
And so it's click, you know, and I guess in the retrospect, it's like, well, they don't know who you are. They don't, you know, they're just hanging up on a phone call.
You're one of many.
Yeah. So whenever we do these interviews, I'm always just like, oh my God, what if they're awful? What if they're a terrible person? And then I realize, well, they've all worked on Fleabag and they're all great.
Exactly. Oh my God. We have to talk more about, because that's also a reason that I didn't become a journalist.
I seriously.
Because I just didn't want to always have to be calling all these random people, especially people that didn't want to hear from me.
Exactly. And didn't want to tell you anything. And then yeah. You like coax stuff out of them.
Because you're right. We both went to journalism school.
Totally. I mean, that's why if I did, I'd work, you could write the craft column or
all, I could.
You know, things where people actually want to talk to you. But like, yes. I'm sorry, some of these like New York Times people who can like call up a chief of staff and be like, I need a quote about this. And you're just like,
I know. And like what before you're a name too. That's why I call doctors and patients. They always want to talk to me. Tell me about things. That's literally how I shaped my career for my comfort level.
So funny. Fortunately, we didn't go into it, and now we met each other, and we got to have a conversation with Dan Gage.
Yes. So it all worked out.
And it made me want to go watch Staged again.
Same.
Which I think I'm going to do. So we might do a stage situation. Who knows?
Yeah.
We do have some thoughts for the future, but in the meantime... We'll talk more about that later. But in the meantime, our next episode should be episode 6 of season 2 of The Scriptures, which does bring us to kind of the end of our official reason to be on the air.
I will.
But we have some thoughts, so don't worry. You'll still hear us yapping in your ear for at least till 2022 when that show premieres.
Right. Oh, gosh. All right. Well, in the meantime, social it up with us. You can email us at thefleabagsituation@gmail.com or join our very fun Facebook group. Just search The Fleabag Situation. We're also on Instagram at Fleabag Situation Podcast and on Twitter at Fleabag Podcast. And we'd love if you gave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, if you so desire. And if you haven't subscribed, please do that too, because then other people can find us.
And just as always, just hang in there, everyone. I know we're coming up on a year of this. It's like still with this. And I know England went back into another lockdown. Some other areas, I know part of Australia is back in lockdown. So we know these just feel like this keeps on dragging on. But what hope that Fauci, at least for the US, was like by April, maybe open season to get vaccinated. So I will be shoving that needle in my arm myself if I need to.
I am impatient for this vaccine.
Very. So all of which to say, we know there's light at the end of the tunnel. We're all getting through it day by day. Give yourself some grace. Give yourself some slack. Take care of yourself.
And go buy some silk pajamas.
Oh my God. Or silk-like pajamas.
Or silk-like.
They don't even have to be silk. Treat yourself to some silk-like pajamas and pretend you are Phoebe Waller-Bridge and your life is immediately better.
That's what I did.
I love it. And I love you, Allie.
I love you too, Chrissy. We love all of you so much. Thank you for bringing us the joy that we are so desperately seeking in these weird times.
And thank you again to Dan Gage for taking time to talk to us. Yeah. Hopefully we'll get to talk to him again in the future. Totally. All right. See you next time.
Bye.
Put your head on my shoulder.
Cow say to the other cow on Zoom.
What?
I can't hear you. You're on on Moon.